Thank you very much for coming out. It's good to be back in Portland, where I went to college, and I am, another Reedy who could never really get a full-time job and hold on to it. Anybody from Reed here? Huh, one. Okay, good. All right. Now, I know, I had a hard time explaining this book when I was working on it because it sounded so weird to say, I'm writing a book that's attacking positive thinking. And it sounds so twisted and mean, like I'm taking a stand against whole grains and world peace or something. So I have to start with this little little defensive note. I am not against having a nice day. I am not against smiling at strangers or partying as much as you want to. In fact, one of the recent books I wrote was a pretty serious historical book called Dancing in the Streets, A History of Collective Joy. So you can't call me a sourpuss. I wrote the book on joy. And what I'm talking about here is an ideology that is so pervasive in American culture that it's hard to even separate it out and put a name to it. The idea that you have to be positive, upbeat, cheerful, optimistic, and if you're not that way already, then you better work to make yourself happy, positive, cheerful, and upbeat. Now, I first encountered this kind of mandatory positive thinking 8 years ago when I was being treated for breast cancer. That diagnosis, of course, came as a terrible shock. I thought you had to have breast cancer, but apparently not. My first impulse was to reach out to other women, and it's mostly women, of course, who get this disease, and for information and for support. So I went to all the websites I could. I ordered all sorts of books, and what I found was not support. What I found, first of all, and I have to say this is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, those pink ribbons were everywhere. And one of the things very early on in my breast cancer experience, I was looking through a local newspaper and came across an ad for a pink breast cancer teddy bear. And for me, that was a very important existential turning point. Because I realized right then that I am not afraid of dying. I am afraid of dying with a pink teddy bear under my arm. And there's a huge amount of infantilization that goes on of breast cancer patients. It's a one foundation in New York was giving out free tote bags to women who are undergoing breast cancer treatment. And I managed to get hold of one of these tote bags, though I was not in New York at the time. And it had, it had some little rhinestone jewelry, it had some moisturizers, it had some cologne, and it had a box of crayons. So I called the foundation in New York, and I said, this is really very nice what you're doing with the tote bags, but what's with the crayons? And she said to me, well, that's in case you have any thoughts you want to write down about your experience. And I said, I am a writer. We don't use crayons anymore. I think men are treated with somewhat more dignity, at least when they're diagnosed with prostate cancer. They're not given gifts of matchbox cars. The other thing I found, in addition to the pink ribbon stuff, is a kind of mandatory optimism everywhere I turned. The fact, cancer isn't a problem. It's not even an annoyance. An annoyance is a gift in the ideology that surrounds it. There's a book called The Gift of Cancer, A Call to Awakening, which tells you that cancer is, quote, your ticket to your real life. You can order a T-shirt if you want from a company online that says, thank you, cancer. Now, I just want to say, if cancer is your idea of a gift, take me off your Christmas list, really. This is, you know, at one point I went into on the Komen Foundation board. Now, the Komen Foundation is the largest of the breast cancer organizations in America, and they, you know, behind all these races and walks for the cure and everything. And I posted something on the message board under the subject line, angry. I do not think it was an insane rant. It was brief. I mentioned my fights with the insurance company. I thought that the current treatments are barbaric. The chemotherapy is barbaric, killing every dividing cell in your body, just to hoping you get some of the cancer cells at the same time. I said, I am furious that we don't know the cause of this disease, which is epidemic in our society. We know it's got to have some environmental basis because it's in a disease of industrialized countries, but we don't know what it is. And then I said something which was perhaps not so nice. I said, I am sick and tired of pink ribbons. I'm not down with the pink ribbon culture. And the kind of responses I got were like this one, a woman who wrote to me and said, Barb, you need to run, not walk, to get some counseling. You know, no anger in this world. And, you know, I came to understand that they were well-meaning, these people who are telling me to smile all the time about it. Because the dogma was, and it remains, that a positive attitude is essential to your recovery from cancer. And today, you know, you hear it everywhere, not just in the case of breast cancer, any kind of cancer, you'll hear, you've got to be positive. Now, how does a positive attitude fight cancer? Well, this sounds, when I say this, it's going to sound so innocuous because you've heard it a million times, is that supposedly the positive attitude boosts your immune system so that the immune system can fight the cancer. We've all heard that, right? Well, as it happens, after Reed, I went on to get a PhD in cellular immunology. So don't mess with me with that kind of thing, you know? And research for Brightsided, I was fortunate that there's very interesting new results out. But first of all, there's no evidence that the immune system fights cancer. There's a good reason for that. The immune system is set up to fight microbes, foreign invaders. Cancer, sadly, is your own cells gone crazy. Secondly, there is no evidence, although there's murky evidence on both sides of this, that a positive attitude boosts the immune system. Extreme stress is bad for the immune system, bad for the whole body. And that many lab animals have been tortured to death to prove that point over the years. More to the point, there are now meta-studies, studies of all the studies that have ever been done on these things, that established that positive people are no more likely to survive cancer than anybody else. And that has been done now for breast cancer, lung cancer, throat cancer, and neck cancer. So there I was, though, in 2001, being told that if I didn't recover from this, it was essentially my own fault because I hadn't worked on my attitude enough. So that was my first encounter with mandatory positive thinking. And, you know, after I recovered from the treatments, I put it out of my mind. It just seemed like some bizarre aspect of the pink ribbon culture, I thought. But in return, you know, mostly what I write about is economic issues. You know, it's been poverty and the decline of the middle class and things like that. What I began to discover a few years ago is that this advice, this exhortation, this command to be positive is everywhere. You know, that it's in every aspect of life. For example, maybe you're not rich, some of you. Possibly. Occasionally. You know, that many, you know, maybe you're actually poor. Well, there are hundreds of self-help books, possibly not all in Powell's, but in other stores, which will explain how you can attract money to yourself by positive thinking. Why has wealth eluded you so far? Don't talk to me about unemployment and low wages and medical bills. You know, those are just excuses in the positive thinking ideology. The real obstacle lies in your mind. Now, in the last decade and a half, a whole industry has grown up in this country to promote positive thinking and make it possible for everybody to achieve it. And this is usually called the motivation industry. You can buy the books, you can buy the CDs, the DVDs. You could go to hear a motivational speaker. We just learned that George W. Bush is now a motivational speaker. And, you know, he will no doubt explain how you can get a job and achieve prosperity. If you have enough money, you can spend a weekend or a week in some exotic location with a heavy-hitting motivational speaker, James Arthur Ray. You know, 2 weeks ago, he had a bunch of people who had paid about $9,700 each for a weekend to learn how to attract wealth to themselves in Sedona, Arizona, and sadly, three of them died in the sweat lodge part of the experience. They were not sending out the right thoughts somehow. Or you can acquire all kinds of little tchotchkes that will boost your mood. There's a line of goods called Successories, which is devoted entirely to little things you can put on your desk, inspirational posters to put on your wall. Then there's this retailer, you've probably seen the Life is Good line of products. I don't know, you know. I mean, I'm not going to argue that proposition. But I do have to wonder about the kind of person who feels they have to declare that on the tire cover on the back of their Jeep. In fact, I was in a grocery store at home in Virginia just 2 weeks ago, and there was a guy behind me wearing a T-shirt saying, "Life is crap." And I thought, my man, you know, finally, I found someone. Now, it's not voluntary, this stuff, not all the time. Those who don't kind of reach out to become more positive themselves may find it forced on them. The biggest source of this is the American workplace. The corporate workplace beginning in the late 80s and increasing right up to 2008, as far as I know, still going on. Corporations started bringing in the motivational speakers and also distributing the motivational books, often for free, to their employees. And the link I make, and I think it's pretty clear, is to downsizing. This all starts with the era of downsizing, and you have to have a way to quell dissent among those being laid off, and you have to have a way to extract still more effort from the survivors of layoffs who now have to do the work of two or three people. So, you know, it clicked with me when I saw this going on, how this was completely paralleled to the breast cancer situation. You take people who are going through a really hard time, and you tell them, first of all, it's not a misfortune at all. It's really an opportunity. And the layoff person is told, what a break. You are now in transition, you know, to something obviously much better, and so on. In breast cancer, the reason it's a gift is that it's going to make you more spiritual and evolved and sensitive. Actually, in my case, it just made me nastier and meaner. And I understand that there is a book, and I have to read this, called Breast Cancer Made Me a Shallower Person. You know, there's a sister. I'd love to find her. And then the other thing, you know, in both cases, you tell that the person going through this difficult patch that positive thinking will cure it. It will cure the cancer. And, of course, if you want to get a job in America, we've been told over and over again, you have to be positive. It's not your skills, it's not your experience, is the positive attitude you will beam out that will give you a job. By the 90s, all the business advice books, self-help books, and the positive thinking books were giving the advice to employers that they should eliminate, quote, negative people from their ranks because they dragged the place down. Anybody here ever been told at work that they were too negative? Whoa. Any normal people here or just, you know? No, I mean, it's the same kind of thing. And there's a really sad breast cancer analogy. Some breast cancer support groups have taken to expelling members whose cancer metastasizes because that's such a bummer, you know, that would could ruin the attitudes of the others in the group. So, you know, there are policies of actually culling out the, quote, negative people, which may mean simply the people who ask questions or, you know, who occasionally express a doubt about the business plan or whatever. But the biggest incentive, you know, those are the coercive things. The biggest incentive to think positively, though, is it will cause great things to happen to you. Anybody here ever read the book The Secret, the mega bestseller of 2006? Okay. And why aren't you rich, huh? This is a book which is really a compilation of different motivational speakers' great insights, one of them being James Arthur Ray, that explains that you can have anything, anything at all, by simply beaming out thoughts into the universe and having this getting this stuff delivered to you. What they say is, and this is not my phrase, it's their phrase, the universe is a big mail order department waiting for you to send in your orders clearly and so on so that you know, fulfillment will occur in a timely fashion. In the book, The Secret, she tells a story of a woman who wanted to attract a man, a husband or a boyfriend, and she didn't, you know, do the usual cosmetic type of route or anything. She cleared out her closet. So half of her closet in her bedroom was empty. And she emptied out half of her garage and sort of started saying to herself, thank you, universe, for sending him. And you know, some poor sucker materialized. Attracted, no doubt, by the closet and the garage. I think I know him. There are other ways to attract things to yourself or to be more positive. For example, you want to be more positive. They'll all tell you, do not read the newspapers. Do not listen to the news. It'll only drag you down. Fortunately, there are some websites like happynews.com where you can get just upbeat news like, you know, sweethearts united after 30 years, enjoy a nice weekend, you know, things like that. It's all there. But, you know, here's how to get rich. I'm going to tell you once, and you can buy the book if you want. This is from a book called Secrets of the Millionaire Mind. Place your hand on your heart and say, I admire rich people. I bless rich people. I love rich people. And I'm going to be one of those rich people, too. So that, you know, that'll bring it to you. If you're a Christian evangelical, then you might want to use God as an intermediary. The whole megachurch phenomenon is, you know, not based, it's not fire and brimstone type of Christianity or anything like that. You go into a megachurch, in fact, and one of the places I went to for this book, Bright Side, it was the largest one in the country, Joel Osteen's church in Houston. And there's not a cross anywhere. No cross crucifixes, no pictures of Jesus. You know why? Because that'll bring you down. If you think about that, you know, that is, oh. Instead, the message is, God wants you to be rich. Why are you standing in his way? You know, it's all, anything you want, you can have because God is waiting. He'll be, you know, the intermediary, bring it to you. Now, some of you may be wondering, why does she care? What's wrong with all this positive thinking, even if it is delusional? You know, why should anybody, you know, be such a spoil sport as to come along and say something wrong with this? Well, let me explain what I think is wrong with it. First, I'm going to take a hard line on this. Delusion is always dangerous. That's my hard line on that. And the example I want to give you is the financial meltdown of 08. Because there were many things that went into that. You know, the greed and exotic financial instruments and so on. But I make the case, I think, pretty strongly in this book, that the mandatory optimism of the corporate world, including the finance sector, was very much a part of this. I mean, first you had all the economists reassuring us that housing prices would always go up. Remember that one? The Dow would reach 36,000 before 2010 and so on. And then a lot of ordinary people, people who attend mega churches, were not wealthy people at all. Were, I would say, encouraged to take on more debt than they could handle. Because what kind of frame of mind do you take on huge debt? Well, first, because you don't have enough money. You know, debt was supposed to be a substitute for low wages in this country. But also, because, you know, if your pastor or other people of some authority or significance in your life are saying, God wants to, quote, prosper you, and then someone comes along with a mortgage that is amazing, no down payment, you know, no proof of income, it must have indeed seemed to a lot of people like, yeah, God has reached down to make sure I get what I want. More than that, though, I blame at the highest levels of the corporate culture, this ideology had completely taken hold. Countrywide mortgage, for example, which arguably set off the whole subprime crisis, has been described by a former vice president who wrote a book about his experience there as a cult. You know, that it was all about high fives and what's that? Make the woo sound you're supposed to make when you're excited. Somebody, please. Oh, thank you. Woo! And that those were, you know, that was what it was characterized, the manic optimism at Countrywide. To speak out, to express some kind of worry about what was going on, was to risk being fired. You know, the one high-level Wall Street banking analyst I talked to, and it wasn't easy for me to get these guys to talk to me, but, you know, he said he had tried to raise questions. And he said that anybody who expressed negativity was thrown out. You just learned to zip your lips and put on a smiley face and so on. The one very clear example of this is the man who headed up the real estate division of Lehman Brothers went to his CEO in 2006, Richard Fuld, and said, I think this housing thing is a bubble, and we better change our business plan. So the guy's fired the next day. Because, you know, you don't want negative people around, right? The American corporate culture has been in a kind of bubble, a delusionary bubble. And this goes right to the top. I always sort of imagined that somewhere on the top were these really smart people, you know, who were cynical about this stuff. But then, as one of my Wall Street insiders that I interviewed told me, said, if you're worth $500 million, really, your thoughts attract things to you. Anything you want, you can have. And they believed it. Now, my other problem with this ideology of positive thinking is that it is cruel. It's just plain cruel. I think this is finally beginning to get some attention in the cancer care industry. I've certainly interviewed and met with oncology nurses and say, don't do this. The patient doesn't need that burden. in addition to his or her illness, the burden of thinking it's their fault if they don't change their attitude in some way. It's the cruelty of this, I think, can be shown by the author of The Secret, comment after the tsunami of 2006. You know, how can bad things happen like that? And she said, in so many words, that the victims of the tsunami must have been sending tsunami-like vibrations into the universe. And other motivational speakers have said similar things about Congo. You know, that, you know, that this, that nothing happens unless you attract it to yourself. It is cruel, I think, to victims of economic hard times, telling people that they're poor because it's something to do with their attitude or their outlook is sheer victim blaming. I can't tell you how many times I've read in, you know, newspaper human interest stories on the recession, and the, some person will be saying, who's unemployed and laid off, and saying, I'm trying so hard to stay positive. And I want to shake them and say, you deserve to be angry, not positive. Why do we cover everything up in this country and put on the smiley face instead of saying, this really sucks and this has got to change? Now, the alternative to positive thinking is not negative thinking. I think it can, that can be just as delusional. I mean, if you imagine that everything you do is going to fail and nothing is ever going to be any fun, yeah, you know, that's, I don't want to, it's not fun to be around that kind of person. The alternative, though, which is really, really radical here, would be realism. Trying to see the world not colored by either our fears or our wishes. Now, that's not easy. It takes a lot, you know, it takes a lot of thinking to do that, and conferring with others and study and so on. And once you identify the situation, understand what's going on, you know, that it isn't like your negative vibrations that caused you to be laid off 6 months ago and lose your health insurance and everything else, then the next realistic step is to take action, which usually means building social movements for change. Now, one final note to end on here is, you might then ask me, and I have been asked this by progressive friends, well, how can you motivate people to be in a social movement for change if they're not pumped up with optimism? You know, if they're not thinking positively and so on. Well, I have a very old-fashioned answer for that. Determination, maybe mixed with a little courage and some hard work too. And I'll give you an example from American history. I'm not really a founding fathers maven or anything like that, but I think it's very interesting that when they signed the Declaration of Independence, they did not have any reason to believe that they could win a war against England. I mean, that was ridiculous to think of that. Furthermore, they knew each of them individually, by signing this declaration, was making himself liable for charges of treason and being hanged by the king. Some of the signers did lose their lives and their fortunes or whatever in the war. The point is, they fought anyway. They didn't have to get pumped into a fit of optimism or delusional, you know, they didn't sit and let's send out independent type vibrations into the universe. No. Now, and I you know, that's, I guess, my kind of core philosophy personally is, I don't know if I will succeed. I don't think I will succeed in the goals I have set for my life. Like eliminating poverty and human suffering around the world. You know, it's too much. It's big. It's huge. And you know, what changes I have made in any way are just molecular compared to the scale of things. But that doesn't stop me from trying. In fact, you know, last word here. I don't need positive thinking to keep on trying and, if necessary, die trying. Thank you.
You've been listening to essayist and author Barbara Ehrenreich talking about her latest book, Brightsided: How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America. In a moment, we'll return to the question and answer session from the presentation. Barbara Ehrenreich is an essayist, author, and activist whose work is published widely. Her books include This Land Is Their Land, Reports from a Divided Nation, Dancing in the Streets, A History of Collective Joy, Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream, Nickel and Dimed, On Not Getting By in America, and Blood Rights, Origins and History of the Passions of War. To find out more about Barbara Ehrenreich and her work, please visit her website at barbaraehrenreich.com. And now we return to the question and answer session from the presentation. Barbara Ehrenreich spoke at Powell City of Books in Portland, Oregon, on October 22, 2009.
Thank you, and we have interest to hear what you have to say. Yes, sir?
The first audience member with a question asked the author what distinguishes this brand of positive thinking from religious movements. With megachurches, members are not required to pay, but with most of the motivational speakers, it's a predatory scheme to part people from their money. And with some of these enterprises, there's a kind of cult-like organization where people spend weekends and give these operations all of their money, and it's the same ideology about success. Does the author deal with this aspect in the book?
Yes. I do deal with it. He's talking about the sort of religious dimensions of this. I mean, it's very hard to distinguish what is said in many of the mega churches from what a secular motivational speaker would say. I mean, that's, and I'm not saying, the criticisms I make of the this brand of theology, the prosperity gospel and so on, have all been made by serious Christians, too. That this had nothing to do with the, you know, the Christian the traditions or the teachings of Jesus. But you know, we get carried away in this country with getting pumped up all the time. So you find it in church, you find it at work, and then you can go home and watch the Secret DVD over and over again. Yes.
The next member of the audience asked if the author had some idea about how Americans compare with other cultures with respect to this positive thinking hype. Do people in Europe go for this?
They think we're nuts. No, it's true. I mean, it's something that it goes into many embarrassing stereotypes of Americans. What's wrong with us? You know, why are you just smiling idiots all the time? You know, and it also is something that Americans take sort of some pride in, often relative to other cultures. And this has been remarked on again and again in literature. It's sort of a American stereotype. Interestingly enough, I mean, we are the center of positive thinking in the world, and I talk about the history and how it began in this country in the book. But we're not the happiest country in the world. And I have to tell you, I don't really trust happiness surveys very much. But for what they're worth, U.S. comes out around 22nd. Finland is ahead of us. You know, we are really low, you know, for what that is worth. Mm-hmm. Yes? Oh, yeah. That's a good point. I don't know if everybody could hear what she said. You know, is there a kind of anti-intellectualism at work with this positive thinking? Oh, yes. You'll find the counsel in all these self-help books. Don't overthink. Don't over-intellectualize. You know, when I was doing research on white-collar unemployment for the book Bait and Switch, I found that quickly. If you ask too many questions about a potential job or something, don't over-intellectualize, you know. No, it's just accept. Mm-hmm. Yes, lady in the pink sweater.
The next member of the audience said that she had also had cancer, and she congratulated the author on her survival of cancer. She asked if the author might be associating some of the positive hype with the commercialization side of this, that we are constantly bombarded by marketing by corporations that are hoping to associate themselves with these campaigns.
Mm-hmm. No, I think, yeah, there's certainly connections to the consumer culture, but I would have been happy to find some kind of economic determinist explanation for all this, but it's not, I couldn't. I mean, this is something that, I mean, that arose before what we call the consumer in the mid-19th century, you know, before even the department store existed or anything like that. I think there are other roots to it. It gets tied in with commercialism, you know, certainly the breast cancer case, just because that's become a kind of branding. You know, everything has a pink ribbon attached to it now. You can get pink drinks and bars and pink, you know, everything. And that's just a way of saying, we're woman friendly, you know, by doing that. And one last thing, I don't call myself a breast cancer survivor. You didn't either. But I don't like that term because it seems to me to put down those who did not survive. And I'm no braver or didn't battle harder or anything than they did. And I just think that's that whole disrespect for people who are victims in the positive thinking ideology bothers me. So I'm trying to get us away from pink ribbons and from talking about I'm a survivor.
This member of the audience observed that the pink ribbons were associated with a campaign sponsor, which said that if you buy this item, we'll donate 1/3 of 1% of the cost to this charity.
Sir? Yeah.
Optimism in government?
Over
optimism in government? I mean, how does this play into...
Well, I think our two most optimistic presidents in my lifetime were Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush. And, you know, George W. Bush carried it to an extreme. He'd been a cheerleader in college, and I think he interpreted the presidency as a continuation of that post. Condoleezza Rice told Bob Woodward, a little late, I think, that she had her doubts about Iraq, the cakewalk of Iraq, remember? But she said, and I'm paraphrasing, but you couldn't say that to the president because he couldn't stand being around, quote, pessimists. And people who raise questions and who express doubts are negative, and that's what you don't want to be around. So he was, you know, another part of the delusionary bubble that we were in. Obama... I'm not real down with the hope thing. I really don't care that much about a politician's hopes. I'm more interested in his or her plans. But certainly we now have somebody who thinks, somebody who can see, you know, who maybe thinks too hard about some things. But it's a complete wonderful change. Yes, sir. No, yeah, you, the camera guy.
The next member of the audience asked if the author saw any relationship to the other trend that we've seen large doses of in the last several months, that is the rise of hate radio, people like Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh, and Ann Coulter, and the teabag protesters. It seems an odd parallel between this super optimism and the rage and resentment that has been harnessed by the right wing so effectively.
Yeah, I think that, no, they are not positive people, and so on. Although, and it's interesting, the politics of this, there are a lot of right-wing connections. Norman Vincent Peale, the author of The Power of Positive Thinking, was a real right-winger. The major money behind positive psychology, the academic branch of all this, has come from the Templeton Foundation, which is extremely right-wing. in what it funds and its outlook. But I don't. But I think that there are also people, you know, plenty of people like Oprah, who have certainly promoted all of this, and nobody could call her a right winger. So no, I don't. You know, my thing about the Tea Party people, the 9/12ers, is. This is a sort of another subject, but we've got two things going on in America. One is the worst economic hard time since the Great Depression. The other is the first black president ever. And they put those things together in some people's minds, and this is what you got. I mean, I looked into this last summer and did some research and interviewed some of these people, and the racism is just about that deep under the surface.
Mm-hmm. The next audience member asked whether, as our optimistic world falls apart around us, are we likely to see a more realistic counter-philosophy emerging, or does the author believe that we're likely to be optimistic unto death?
I'm trying. It seems to me that this is a good time to say, look at the ruins, you know, look what happened. As a result that you can trace to this kind of positive thinking. Even as we are being told in the midst of this recession often, oh God, if you just be optimistic again and go out and spend more money, actually we can't even borrow the money to spend it anymore, so that doesn't work. Yeah, so I think it's a time when things could go a lot of ways.
The same member of the audience referred back to the author's earlier comments that there had been several instigators of this optimism back in the 19th century. Could the author describe one or two of these early optimists?
Yeah, I'm actually quite sympathetic to the originators of positive thinking in the 19th century. They were some kind of independent thinking people, not formally educated. The most important of them was a watch repairman in Maine. And they were rebels against the dominant Calvinism of their time. Calvinism said, you're wretched sinners, you will probably spend eternity being tortured in hell, and so on. That was Calvinism. It really depressed people. It made people sick, physically sick. There was an epidemic in the 19th century of, quote, neurasthenia. Because, you know, of this ideology. And so some of the early people, Mary Baker Eddy is the best known of them, actually, said, no, it's not that bad. It's a God of love, and the world is bountiful, and Mary Baker Eddy said a lot of totally crazy things, like you can have anything you want. You know, she's a direct antecedent of the kind of thinking in The Secret. But it started as a rebellion against Calvinism, and I have some respect for that. Mm-hmm. Did I interview Oprah for the book? Funny guy. No, I mean, she's been pretty clear. She has promoted one motivational speaker and thinker after another, as has Larry King and Ellen DeGeneres, so I wouldn't single her out. But of course, it's kind of, you know, this is tricky area here. Here I am, an author on a book tour with a new book, and you want me to diss Oprah? Yes.
The next member of the audience asked what the author's experience had been on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart.
Oh, did you see it?
I did.
Yeah. Oh. It was actually fun. I mean, I was kind of, you know, I thought I'd be nervous, but when I got there, I wasn't nervous. And mainly, he's just a sweetheart. And not all of these people are. A lot of them won't even make eye contact unless they have to when the camera's rolling. But he just was very nice and pleasant, and actually chatted with me for a moment before and a moment after, which is unusual. Yes, ma'am.
The next member of the audience observed that many of the questions had been about links between this optimism and various institutions. Has the author considered a relationship between this culture of optimism and the concept of American exceptionalism. This audience member related her question to the earlier question about optimism in relation to other countries. She said that she had lived abroad for many years, and that the base level culture in terms of how you treat difficult periods of time in your life is very different on the continent compared to here in the United States. And she wondered if this was just a version of this relentless optimism.
Yes. That's a very good point, and it's one that I touch on, but that there's this whole American triumphalism. We're the best. We've got the best health care, you know. on and on. I've certainly run into that a lot in trying to talk about poverty and issues of economic inequality. People say, well, why are you knocking America? What have you got against America? You know, because we have to be the best in all ways. And it's very much tied up with this positive thinking. Yes?
The next member of the audience asked if the author had considered the generational aspect of this problem. She observed that younger people have come of age with The Daily Show and YouTube and a more decentralized media. She wonders if this younger generation is less bright-sided than past generations, and asked if the author touched on this in her book.
I don't know. It's an interesting point. Whether we could do a poll right here, I guess.
Another audience member supported this idea, saying that he was generally regarded as the wet blanket in his family.
Oh, great.
This member of the audience described his mother, who puts post-it notes up throughout the house with encouraging messages like, you look good today and hope you get that great job you're after. Very positive messages. And it seems like this book resonates more with him than with his mother.
Well, maybe we should. And it doesn't resonate with you, with your mother. Put you on a spot here. it's an interesting it's an interesting thought. I sense that sometimes, but I think there's an awful lot of young people who, you know, for example, who are very much fans of The Secret, and that sort of thing. You know, that there's I have not noticed it's particularly restricted to those of us who are old and foolish. Yes, sir.
The next member of the audience agreed with the author's earlier comments about economic determinism. He said that if we can agree that part of this optimism is a manic defense against our own misery, and if we think that the objective misery level in this country has gone up dramatically in the last 20 years, it suggests that the more miserable you are, the more prone you would be to be subject to this mindless optimism as a defense against your own heightened insecurity.
No, I think that's the point. I actually assembled a support group when I was working on this book, because I really felt like I'd gone too far out this time. And I found a group, I guess we're up to about 8 people now. They're academics, but I needed academic, you know, input on a lot of this. And one of them argues, a sociologist would argue that point, but I argue back and say, I don't see it. I mean, this stuff was, peaking at the time in the late 90s, before the dot-com bust. It comes right back, you know, it wasn't even interrupted by the dot-com bust and that little recession. It's remarkably resistant, especially when you have corporations who buy it and impose it on people. You know, in that way, I mean, you could say it's linked to hard times. I would say that. It's linked to hard times, and that this has been, you know, the opiate you're supposed to take as you become a disposable American worker, which everybody has become. Mm-hmm.
The next member of the audience said that she thought this seems to be a perfect form of social control. In the current environment, where it's tough to find a job, and employers are making people work longer hours for less pay, and then telling their workers, you should feel positive, you're lucky to have a job.
Yeah. No, that's what I think, too. In fact, here's an interesting thing that I learned in the course of this. There is another kind of culture, which was extremely or was extremely mandatory to be optimistic, and that was Soviet communism. You don't usually think of that as a real cheerful kind of arrangement, but the Soviet Union, and it's true of North Korea still today, was you have to be an optimist. Not to be an optimist was to be a defeatist, and that could land you in the labor camp. So it wasn't about capitalism in that case, or the consumer culture, or any of that. It's about power. It's about how do you maintain a hierarchical society where most people, how do you get people to go along, without actually flogging them every step of the way? I think we have time for just one or two more. One, sir, in the back of the man with the beard.
The next member of the audience asked if the author had related any of the positive thinking hype to religions that promise rewards in the afterlife.
That is an interesting question. Whether the expectation of heaven on the part of several religions anyway is a form of positive thinking. Yeah, I guess you're right. I think though that in the olden days, heaven was what you got if you were real good in this life. Now, it's that heaven is almost dropped from the picture with the positive thinkers, because you can have everything now. I mean, I think it was Reverend Ike, who was the African-American prosperity gospel preacher, very popular in the 70s, who, kind of said, why wait to die? You can have it now. So they kind of speeded it up, the whole thing. Okay, one more easy question. All right, but the woman with the green shirt.
The next member of the audience asked if there were a gender dimension to this, that there were differences in expectations for men and women based on gender stereotypes, women being expected to be more happy and not to show their true emotions.
What are the gender dimensions of all this? That is a very interesting point. I mean, how many women here have been told at one point or another, come on, honey, give me a little smile. Yeah. and there's definitely the expectation of women particularly have to exude positivity so that we're like, I mean, the whole idea here in positive thinking is that we're not interesting individuals with problems and insights and so on. We're just the wallpaper in other people's lives, and women especially. You gotta be up so that you boost the moods of everybody else. And if there was a campaign, I think Gloria Steinem tried it sometime in the 70s to get women not to smile for a day. And they say feminists had no sense of humor. But I love that, because we're all so sick of that. I'm smiling all the time. So on that happy note, maybe we should. Thank you for coming.
You've been listening to essayist and author Barbara Ehrenreich talking about her latest book, Brightsided: How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America. To find out more about Barbara Ehrenreich and her work, please visit her website at barbaraehrenreich.com. Barbara Ehrenreich spoke at Powell City of Books in Portland, Oregon on October 22, 2009. This program was produced by PDX Justice Media Productions. To find out more about our work and to access our growing library of free on-demand streaming video and audio programs, please visit our website at www.pdxjustice.org. You'll find programs featuring speakers such as Noam Chomsky, Susan Faludi, Amira Haas, Jeff Halper, Natalie Angier, and many, many others. And write to us with your comments and questions at pdxjustice@riseup.net. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks for supporting listener-sponsored radio, public access cable television, net neutrality, independent bookstores, and all forms of grassroots, democratic, community media.